The state of American manufacturing was a big part of the last presidential campaign. Here's then-candidate Donald Trump at a campaign rally in Florida 2 years ago.
We're going to renegotiate NAFTA. Probably the worst trade deal ever agreed to, signed in the history of the world, not in the United States. It's destroyed our manufacturing in our country.
For Trump, the problem was trade deals and China. But there's another argument. Some economists say the real reason we lost manufacturing jobs was because of automation. But our next guest says the president was on the right track. Gwynne Gilford is a reporter for Quartz who covers the global economy. She's with us now to talk about her recent piece for Quartz, The Epic Mistake About Manufacturing That's Cost Americans Millions of Jobs. Gwynne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
Well, I want to break this kind of a complicated story. I want to break it down one step at a time. First, one thing I think everybody agrees on, we have lost manufacturing jobs in the United States. Can you talk about the scale and scope of that?
Yeah, so basically, manufacturing jobs had been relatively stable for a while in the 80s and 90s, and then all of a sudden you hit 2000 and they start, they plummet. And they lost, the manufacturing sector lost around 6 million jobs between 2000 and 2010, and that's recovered a little bit, but we're nowhere near close to where we were in, even before the Great Recession, 2006, let alone where we were in 2000. It's still close to, it's about close to 5 million jobs that have been lost.
Now, a lot of people, in some ways, the conventional wisdom was this is outsourcing, this is jobs moving overseas, but there was this argument, well, it's automation, and looking at some of the numbers, some of the measures of production and manufacturing, even as we're losing jobs, it looks like we're producing a lot of stuff. We're producing a lot of value worth of stuff. So that must mean it's automation. Fewer workers are producing more stuff. But you write that actually there's a problem in how we measure that value of the stuff we produce that really skews the picture. Can you explain that to us?
Right. So when economists are trying to figure out how a sector is doing, they need to compare how much volume you're producing this year versus the last year versus the year before that. And, you know, there are things that can distort that, like price. So when prices go up, you know, because of inflation or something, it could be that you sold a lot more, or it could just be that the prices went up. So they control for that. And another thing, like, that's pretty straightforward. And you do that with everything to get the real versus nominal output amount, right? So, but the weirder one is the quality adjustment. And this is done when you have dramatic increases in the quality of a product. So, for instance, you know, this is a very hypothetical example because, you know, we don't make iPhones in the U.S. They're made in China. Everybody knows that. But let's just say, let's take a thing everyone's familiar with, the iPhone. Okay. So from 1 year to the next, iPhones, you know, increase in, you know, their photo quality, their memory, their speed, all these performance aspects, and people will pay more for them. You know, right now you can buy an iPhone 8, 7, and 6 on the if you go into an Apple store, and, you know, the prices are, you know, quite different. So what the statisticians need to do is, like, they recognize that an iPhone 8 is not really comparable to an iPhone 6 because you're getting, the consumers are getting so much more value out of an 8 because it can do so much more. So to make them comparable, they need to adjust for that quality difference the same way you would do with prices. But what they do is they look at the difference in prices between the, you know, say this year's model and one from last year, and say, okay, that reflects the value to consumers. And, you know, so if the iPhone 8, say, costs twice as much as the iPhone, you know, 7, then and one iPhone 8 must be counted, they count it as equal to selling two iPhone 7s. So that could, when you have that quality adjustment applied to particularly this very small sector called the computers and electronics sector, where all of these products are increasing in quality really fast because technology is improving really quickly, what it does is it makes it either, you could interpret these huge leaps in output either as an increase in the sales volume, or it's, you know, that what it reflects is the statistician's assumption that people are valuing the iPhone or the processor or whatever product a lot more because of that superior performance.
And then your piece, you look at economists and others who have stripped out that computer and electronics sector you were just talking about. Take it out of the numbers, separate it. What does the rest of the manufacturing world look like when you don't include that that value increase adjustment?
Yeah, so when you take it out, it turns out that manufacturing hasn't been growing at nearly the pace that it seems to have been when you just look at the official top-line data. And it's actually very hard to strip that out because of some complicated methodological things. So it's not well known that there is this quality adjustment that is sort of distorting the output data. But basically, it makes it look like manufacturing is doing a lot better than it is, and really, like, it hasn't been growing at nearly the pace of the private sector, of the rest of the private sector.
So the conclusion then you're making is, and that others are making, is that this shows, when you do this, it shows automation isn't really driving job loss. It is more job loss to countries overseas.
That's right. So, yeah, there's no research that has demonstrated that investment in IT and machines and robots and stuff like that has coincided with the job loss. Like, yes, there is automation in manufacturing for sure, but it's not taking place. It hasn't taken place it hasn't been taking place faster than other sectors, at least since the 2000s. So what happened in the 2000s? Well, 2001, China exceeds the WTO. That was a huge factor. Also, it's after the 1997 Asian financial crisis, and a lot of Asian countries start hoarding U.S. dollars. And that has the effect of making U.S. dollars more expensive and, therefore, U.S. exports more expensive. And so that is definitely a factor. And, you know, the trade agreement thing is a little bit more complicated, but yes, these have the evidence is starting to pile up that trade competition did definitely hurt U.S. manufacturing, and those effects have been, you know, lasting.
And how much of the story is what you just mentioned first there, China?
It's really hard to get to quantify the effects of this stuff because, you know, in part because the automation story has been so dominant, there hasn't been a ton of research into what exactly has caused the decline in U.S. manufacturing. So we don't know. But China was definitely a massive factor because, you know, in large part because China is huge. But also because, you know, what happened in 2001 was that basically China did manipulate its currency. It set, it made its currency artificially cheaper. And when it joined the WTO, multinationals, U.S. companies could then be confident that, you know, if it continued to do that, the U.S. wasn't going to slap tariffs on Chinese goods, so they could move to China and take advantage of, you know, the cheap labor, but also the cheap currency.
We're talking to Gwen Guilford, reporter for Quartz, about what's driving the loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States. She says when you look at the numbers, it's more a story of foreign competition than a story of automation taking workers out of their jobs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you used to work in manufacturing? Have you seen your line, your factory move out of the country or the factory in your community? Did President Trump's statements about manufacturing and job loss ring true to you? What do we do about it? Call in and tell us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about what's behind the decline in American manufacturing. Gwen Guilford is with us, reporter for Quartz. She's been writing about this, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in manufacturing? Are you in the profession or in the business in Wisconsin? Have you seen jobs lost in your community? What is the solution? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Gwen, let's talk about that issue of solutions. The president and his administration are announcing likely tariffs. A lot of them have been on hold lately. Are tariffs part of the answer to this problem?
So tariffs can be good when you're a developing nation. For instance, you know, they were really important for helping the U.S. develop when it first became a country. And, you know, lots of Asian countries have modeled themselves off that policy, their development policies off that. But, you know, the U.S. is obviously not a developing country, and ultimately what tariffs do is they tax consumers and other businesses in order to protect a certain industry. And, you know, that's a big trade-off. Is that really going to help nurture industry in the U.S.? No, not really, probably not. Like, there's plenty of capital that could be invested, plenty of entrepreneurs. Like, you know, we don't really need to protect U.S. Businesses from foreign competition so much as perhaps, you know, create new incentives for high-tech investments and things like that.
Let's go to our callers now. Martin is with us in Ripon. Martin, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm sorry to rain on the parade here, but a lot of what's being said is not only wrong, but I think your guest ought to think about what she's really contributing to politically, where the scapegoating of foreign trade and foreign countries ends up. If you look at manufacturing jobs as a percentage of the U.S. workforce, it's been a steady decline ever since World War II. Look at the graph. It's steadily down. There's not a huge drop-off in 2000. Secondly, the value of U.S. manufacturing has never been higher. And you should see what's going on here, you know, in Fond du Lac County. Mercury Marine, record sales, doubled their employment. Alliance Laundry, same exact story, but they depend on global sales.
Martin, thanks a lot for the call. Gwen, looking at your charts, or the charts you shared in your story, the number of manufacturing jobs you were writing was holding pretty steady, actually, up until that changing point, even if it maybe wasn't rising as a percentage of jobs before that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And Martin has a good point. A lot of people point this out. The share has been declining since the 40s, and the share of manufacturing as like a share of total employment. You know, something similar happened in agriculture, and people like to draw parallels to that. But what happened with agriculture, is that, you know, you saw jobs drop really fast as a share of overall employment, and then they flatten out. And that's not really what we've seen in manufacturing. Like, if they keep on going the way they're going, they're just going to hit zero. So, you know, the analogy doesn't really hold. And, you know, what's probably more informative is the absolute number of jobs lost. Now, the other thing is the value of U.S. manufacturing has never been higher. That's exactly the thing that I was talking about in my story. The way we measure that is it mischaracterizes what is actually happening because of the disproportionate influence of computers and electronics and the quality adjustment for the products they make. So, you know, the value of U.S. manufacturing actually has been higher. It's not growing at the rate it should be. And the other thing to consider here is that manufacturing is not like other sectors. It's not like services, say. It provides jobs that tend to be very steady and well-paid. And it also, R&D is a very essential, you know, has a very important relationship with factories. Like, you design something, you want to, like, produce it, and then there's, you know, interaction back and forth between the R&D facility and the factory while they figure out, you know, they tinker with the design. And so when you lose factories, you also lose that innovative capacity that comes from having R&D facilities. And that's a really important job creator, but also source of technological innovation that does give U.S. manufacturing or anywhere else a competitive edge. So that's something else that the U.S. has also lost out on. I'm not saying that, like, that trade with other countries is, I mean, trade with other countries is good. That's the problem. Like, free trade has gotten a bad name in all of this, and free trade is actually not the problem here. What we're talking about are mechanisms that prevent trade from being free, like not letting a currency adjust to, you know, the price it should be.
Let's spend our last couple minutes on that, Gwen. You said tariffs, generally speaking, not the answer to the problem here. I understand China has backed off in some ways from its currency manipulation. Are there things that the United States can do that would make a difference for manufacturing jobs?
Yeah, that's a great point. In the last 2 years, it really hasn't been an issue. In 2016, heck, it wasn't an issue. If anything, the renminbi has been losing value and their government has been selling down their assets in order to try to prop up the value. So, but other countries are still doing this, and it doesn't mean that that couldn't change. So, for instance, Korea is a pretty notorious and consistent manipulator of currencies. It's also a manufacturing powerhouse and competes with the U.S. We just renegotiated a free trade deal with it and did not address the currency issue. And this doesn't have to be a combative thing. It just needs to be, you know, the U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency, and that gives other countries the opportunity to buy a whole bunch of it, you know, and, you know, defend, to prop up their own employment as a result. And, you know, it, we could collectively decide not to do that anymore. That would probably be the best thing to do, but it could also be negotiated in bilateral deals.
And briefly, as we wrap up, if we keep on focusing on automation as the cause of manufacturing job losses, do you see that leading us into more trouble?
Yeah, it seems like we should probably confront the problem that communities and many people around the U.S. face in order to start, you know, making the economy structure more balanced and make it work for, you know, it sounds corny, but more people. And continuing to believe that U.S. factories are at the cutting edge because they've got all these robots is, like, actually not what's going on. And it deludes us into thinking that the U.S. is more competitive than it is in this very, very crucial sector. So, you know, in order to come up with the solutions, you first have to acknowledge the problems.
Gwen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Gwen Guilford, a reporter who covers the global economy for Quartz. We were talking about research that shows automation is not the main factor for the decline in American manufacturing. It's more international competition. Organic food has grown into a $50 billion industry, but some Wisconsin farmers say they no longer trust that all certified producers are meeting the industry's standards. Hope Kerwin has more on how questioning the organic label could impact the industry's future.
Crunching through spring snow, Harriet Behar heads toward the high tunnel on her farm. Similar to a greenhouse, the high tunnel has heavy translucent plastic that insulates Behar's organic spinach plants from the cold.
When we start getting, you know, 45, 50 degree days, this is just going to get huge. But you can see it's been picked all winter.
Behar says she's harvested spinach 6 or 7 times over the winter, a pretty productive crop for her farm. But when it comes to competing with hydroponic operations, where spinach is grown indoors in nutrient-filled water, Behar says it's hard for her to keep up.
It's kind of like food on steroids. You know, because they're in a controlled environment, they don't have, you know, wind or no sun. I mean, they're under lights. This is a big difference.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture allows hydroponic operations to be certified as organic. But farmers across the country have been debating for almost a decade whether these soilless farms really meet the standards for their industry. Behar says the problem is that hydroponics doesn't improve soil quality or protect natural resources, things that traditional organic farmers are required to document in order to be certified. Because of these exceptions and increasing reports of fraud in the industry, Behar says many producers feel the USDA organic label doesn't guarantee the same quality that it once did.
If we're certified organic and the other people are certified organic, there's no way to distinguish ourselves in the marketplace, and we think consumers care, so we're going to have this add-on label.
Called the Real Organic Project, Behar says the new label is meant to be an extension of the USDA organic seal, guaranteeing that crops are grown in soil and livestock and dairy producers are following animal welfare standards. But traditional organic farmers aren't the only ones frustrated with the National Organic Program. Some hydroponic producers, like Brian Ernst in Ripon, say they also think the organic label has lost some of its integrity.
Indoor farm is really starting to adopt a post-organic philosophy.
Ernst says when he started Ernesti Farms 4 years ago, he wanted to be certified organic. Now, he feels like the industry is commercially driven, and he doesn't think indoor farms like his need the label to be successful.
Just because customers see the USDA organic, you know, little symbol on a clamshell, doesn't necessarily give the customer all the information they're looking for.
Some in the industry worry that if farmers continue to lose faith in the USDA seal, it could hurt the force that has made organic worth a premium. John Mesko is executive director of the Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Service. He says the USDA does not promote organic food as being worth more than conventionally produced food.
The real value that gets added to the organic label has come from farmers, food producers and distributors, retailers, co-ops. All of those folks have been the ones promoting organic and the certified organic label as beneficial.
And Mesko says the community needs to remain united in order for organics to keep growing.
We have to proceed as a community with caution to make sure that we don't create so much confusion that we lose the momentum behind the broader organic movement.
But Harriet Behar doesn't see the Real Organic Project's add-on label as a reason for division. In fact, she's hoping it will be a rallying cry for farmers across the country.
This might be a push to the National Organic Program to improve what they're already doing, to kind of show that the organic community wants to do this, and if they're not going to do it, we're going to do it on our own.
Behar says consumers will start to see the new organic add-on label on products in 2019. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we spend a lot of time in our own neighborhoods, but a guest makes the case that we need to go one step beyond and explore the world outside of our comfort zone. We'll visit a massive art and music festival in Milwaukee featuring the creative work of hundreds of high school students. And the author of The Truth About Animals joins the show to clear up misconceptions about sloths, eels, hippos, and more. This has changed what I think about sloths, I promise you. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.